All right, hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9, coming at you, all right, there we go. Let me start that introduction again. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9, coming at you from the very center of the universe. It helps to have the slider up. Thanks, Todd, for boosting me and saying, oh, we're not hearing each other on the headphones there. So that's good stuff here, too. So lots of moving parts here. Hey, and I'm sitting in the studio. This is The Rabbit Hole, and we're moving into Writer's Talk and sitting in the studio here with Todd Fonestock, my old friend. So welcome, Todd.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Right.
And let's get your mic fired up a little bit and try that. Thank you again. Oh, my God. You know, it's a good thing I'm not a technical engineer of some sort.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, it's it's a pleasure. It really is. I remember the last time we had talked, and you had come out with a number of young adults YA books, and I remember you talking about what got you into writing there. And it was storytelling to your kids. I want you to tell that story again. It was so great.
Sure. Well, that was the Wishing World series, which the first one came out in 2016, the second one 2017. And I'm working on the third one. I'm not sure if that's going to come out this year or in 2019. But yeah, it started out as an opportunity to tell my kids stories. So essentially I was working my day job at the time, which I don't have anymore. I came home from work one day, and my wife had been the one who always puts the kids to bed. And I came home one night, and apparently they had been a little more cantankerous than usual. And she essentially came up to me and said, "I'm done. It's you. You take them. You put them to bed." And I thought, you know what? I'm putting together tens of thousands of dollars of deals a day at my job, and I can certainly go up and put a bunch of kids to bed, or at least a couple of kids to bed. And so I went up there, and I pointed my finger at them, and I said, "Go to bed." And that was like when the monkeys started jumping around the cage, because that just didn't work at all. So I had to stand back and regroup and think, okay, so I'm going to have to come at this from a different angle. I'm a storyteller. What can I do to put them to bed? So I started telling them a story, is what I did. And I told them a story about Hugo the Turtle. And Hugo the Turtle moved very, very, very slowly, and he did everything he did very, very, very slowly. And so, as you might imagine, it was this psychological attempt to put my kids to bed by boring them to sleep. And it worked. The first 2-3 nights, they went right to sleep. After about 20 minutes, I was feeling very successful, but also bored to death myself. I was falling asleep, so that's when I started coming up with some more interesting characters. That's how the whole story started. And once I got done with the story arc of those characters, my daughter was on my case nonstop to make it into a book. She said, "You write books, why don't you take this and make it into a book?" And that's the book that ended up becoming The Wishing World.
That is wonderful stuff there. And, and as you were going, very, very, and my head was starting
right
to go off.
So I do that. I do that talk at elementary schools, and I use that same device. And at the end of it, I raise my hand and I say, "So how many here are wanting to go to sleep at this point?" And inevitably, 60, 70% of the class raises their hands. I'm like, "See, I gotcha."
Yeah. And then, of course, the teachers pick up on that and say, "Okay."
Of course.
Slow down a lot. But that got you into writing for yourself. And most of your works, I think, up till now, if not all of them, have been in the children and young adults genre. Is that correct?
Correct. So I write fantasy of all stripes, and The Wishing World is probably the most popular series that I've written at this point. But in the past, I've also written epic fantasy, which epic fantasy is Lord of the Rings. I don't know if you would classify that, or at least when Lord of the Rings came out, I don't think there was such a genre as YA, but it probably would be classified as YA now. I mean, it's a fantasy world, and mm-hmm. is accessible to anybody who is precocious enough to get into the long descriptions and that sort of thing. So I would classify epic fantasy in many cases as YA as well. Of course, there are epic fantasy genre or subgenres that are not for kids. Game of Thrones is one that jumps to mind. But I would say these days, the sort of standard mainstream epic fantasy could be classified under YA, and that's what I do. And then also, so The Wishing World is even for younger audiences. I wouldn't classify it as YA. I would classify it as middle grade, which would be grade 3 through grade 8, probably. Mm-hmm. And young adults, you know, probably somewhere in the gray area of, you know, 8th, 9th, all the way up through college, I would say. Okay. But it depends. I mean, it really depends. But those were the areas, as you say, that I worked in. It was pretty much middle grade and YA. So grades 3 all the way up through, you know, college age, I would say.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for our listeners who, you know, how does one get classified there? Because we have reading levels. So I think there's two major factors go into whether something will be in terms of YA. And one is content itself.
Yep.
As long as it's not adult-oriented.
Sure.
And we get what that means. And then also readability, the reading level.
Yes.
If it's more sophisticated, if you get into the Dune series, for example,
right.
And give it to a sixth grader, more than likely, she is not going to be able to get it.
Yep, true. And I would say, at least with my books, I've noticed that the readability seems to span the whole gamut. In fact, the Threadweavers series, which just came out this year, it was May, June, July, I had put together this. This was a story that was a long, long time coming, and I finally decided to release it. And when I decided to release it, I wanted to do it month 1, 2, and 3 and have them all come out real close together so that people could read the entire story. So that was the plan. The plan deviated, which I could get into later. But anyways, so that was aimed towards, I would say, 14 years old and up. Well, mm-hmm. A friend of mine, his daughter, who's 10 actually, read the series and loved it. I have this little clip, this voice clip that she sent me a voicemail. She called and left a message on my phone. And she's so cute. It was so complimentary. And she was just like, this is my favorite series ever. And thank you so much for writing the series. It was just such a great voicemail. And I called my friend back and said to him, you know, I wish there was a picture frame. And maybe there is. Maybe I just don't know about it. A picture frame where I could frame her picture and then upload the MP3 into the picture so that anytime I was feeling low about my writing or like, oh nice. Man, I'm just in the doldrums, I could go push a little button and have her saying, oh, this is my favorite book ever. So that was, she was an example of somebody who I would have classified as much younger than the age group that should, mm-hmm. not content-wise, but like vocabulary-wise, right. Then should be able to read this book. But boy, she zipped through it and got, at least based on what I can tell with the small conversations I've had with her father, she's gotten all the nuances that I went to put in there. She's pretty whip-smart, though, so I don't think that's necessarily common, but it is an example of how I think sometimes you write for 14 and up and there are other kids that could get really into it. I mean, I know that when I was 14 and 15, I was probably reading books that others would consider to be more for adults, but you know, teenagers are kind of that way. Like they want whatever the next thing is. They want to, you know, do what the adults are doing a lot of times.
But you're right. And, you know, I was a teacher. And so we, you know, constantly at seeing, we have students who are not quote reading at grade level. Okay, for whatever reason, they're not, you know, if it was ninth grade, I was teaching their reading at a fifth grade level, but their sophistication in terms of the world, they were not fifth graders.
Right.
Okay, they were already going through the puberty stages, et cetera, mm-hmm. and aware of all the other adult things. And so the reverse happens as well. You point out a young friend who at 10 years of age might not have, or probably, you know, more than likely, understood all the ramifications of adult themes.
Right.
But her reading level, not only the vocabulary, but the complexity of sentences, the weaving of thoughts, mm-hmm. all that goes
themes
into readability.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, and you're hitting right on it there. And so, you know, someone might look at the content of a book that you think, okay, this is more for a 15-year-old in terms of, and when I say content, I'm not talking about the themes here.
Sure.
But the readability of it, more for high school, and yet there's this little, you know, upper level elementary, early middle school student reading, breezing right on through it.
Yep. Yep. And mm-hmm. and I mean, it's been my experience that kids are going to find the level that makes sense to them.
Right.
You know, you can mm-hmm. try and encourage them to read above their level, or you can try and keep them from reading above their level. But you know what? Yeah. By and large, there's so much information out there. They're going to get to it if they want to get to it.
Yeah, the good part is to get them to read.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the, you know, that's the underlying bonus all along the way, right?
Exactly. Get you hooked right there. So, yeah. But let's move on, because you come out with this new work. It's called Charlie Fiction.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now, that's not YA.
So that's not YA. Nope. That's I wrote that one for the adults out there. So those of you that like a good time travel urban fantasy, that one's for you. It's interesting. That book started as I'm constantly evolving my craft, my ability to write. I always want to get better, and I'm constantly looking for new ways to get better. And that actually started as an exercise for me to improve my own writing craft. It wasn't supposed to be a book. It was just an exercise. I had been studying and actually teaching a workshop on, I teach with another fellow author friend of mine, Chris Mandeville. We do a lot of workshops sometimes together. And one of the ones that we built together is called Building Better Beginnings. And it's all focused on that first paragraph and that first page of a book. Because mm-hmm. in this day and age where people can get their entertainment fix in 30 seconds on an app, on their phone, some game that they're playing, if you're an author and you want to catch somebody's attention, you don't get 50 pages anymore. Mm-hmm. You don't get 20 pages. You don't even get 10 pages anymore. You got to get them in the very first paragraph, sometimes in the very first line. One of the my favorite examples that I use for this is The Martian by Andy Weir. Mm-hmm. Have you ever read it?
I haven't read it, but I've seen the movie.
Everybody yep.
has.
So
you know,
do this. In. Go to Amazon's good for this. So go to Amazon and just like open the first page of the book and read the first line. Mm-hmm. Andy does so much work in that first line that it just blew me away. This book had been recommended to me by about half a dozen people. That's usually what it takes to get me to read a book these days, just because I'm so busy writing that I oftentimes right. don't have time to read as much as I would like. So usually I'm pretty selective, and this one was recommended, The Martian was recommended to me by five, maybe six different people before I finally went and was like, okay, I'm going to go take a look at it, and if it hooks me, great. And it had me by the very first line. And that was impressive. He set the tone, he set the voice, he set the plot all in one line and continued with that voice throughout the entire story, just built upon it and built upon it. And of course, anybody who's read The Martian knows that the voice of the main character is one of the most compelling things about the whole story. Not to say that there aren't other huge compelling things in the story, but the voice of that character is impressive. So I was like, okay, what can I do mm-hmm. to make my best first paragraph? And that's how it started. I wanted it to be shocking. I wanted it to encapsulate the main character's voice. I wanted it to address the plot, like where are we going? And I wanted it to make the reader ask a question, at least one question and maybe two. You know, what happened and why did it happen and who is this person that's talking to me? Those kinds of questions that get readers to move through the story. So I wrote this paragraph, and I remember carrying the paragraph around to test it on people and say, okay, so would you read this further? Because at the time, I was working as the director of development at the American Diabetes Association, so I took it into the office and I started reading it to my fellow coworkers and getting their response. And to a person, they were like, what? Where's the rest of it? I'm like, I didn't write the rest of it. This is just an exercise. This is just an exercise to get me going. And so because of the response, I thought, well, maybe I should see what I can do with it, right? And it was completely non-traditional in my way of working as I started working on this novel. And by non-traditional, I mean typically what I would do is I'd come up with an idea and I'd kind of lay out a plot. And sometimes I would even write little paragraph synopses of the plot and then follow this, paragraph synopses of each chapter that follow the plot and then start writing the chapters as I go. In this one, it was just completely out of the blue. And I wrote maybe four, maybe five chapters, not many, but most of them were just sociological rants. They were me talking about what I didn't like about this part of our society or that part of our society and how we rely on this to make ourselves feel better when we should really be looking at that to try and make ourselves feel better, and the whole, you know, pill for every ill kind of culture, and how I just don't like that. I'm like, there's so many things that we can do before we have to rely on medicine to help us out. And I, don't get me wrong, I think that medicine is fantastic, and when you need it, you need to take it. But I think in so many instances, we jump to that so quickly because we don't want to do the work to make ourselves healthier or to make ourselves feel better. And it's not just physical health. Like, there are, you know, mental health aspects to that. And anyways, so this was just this platform for me to kind of go off, right? And I didn't think anybody was ever going to read it. It didn't have any structure. It didn't have any form. It wasn't really a book. And so I let it sit, right? And then about a year later, and I had been thinking about the idea for, so from this moment, about 5 years, from the moment that I put together those five chapters, it had been a couple of years, maybe 2.5 years. And I set it aside. I was like, I've got all these kind of ranting chapters and I don't know what it is. And I've got this cool voice, but I don't know where it's going. And I sort of set it down. Well, about a year after that, I went to Pikes Peak Writers Conference, and this was in 2017, I want to say. So last year. Was it last year? It was last year. So 2017, and I was working on the other epic fantasy series that I was working with. And I was at the conference and ended up talking with Donald Moss, a good friend of mine, used to be my agent. He's an agent in New York, big name in the industry if you're a fantasy and science fiction writer. And he kind of said, let's go, you know, grab a moment, because usually at these conferences, Donald Moss is just mobbed by all of these authors that want to talk to him or potentially get him as their agent and that sort of thing. So we snuck away to a part of the lobby to just chat and catch up. And I was telling him kind of that I was doing this and doing that. And he's like, okay, so you've got these books that you're working on. And, you know, how many fans are waiting for them? You know, is it 5,000? Is it 50,000, like how many fans are waiting for those? And I'm like, I don't know how many fans are waiting for those books. He's like, well, what's the book that you haven't written that 20 million fans are waiting for? And he's like, which one's that book? And I don't know why, but instantly I was thinking, okay, Charlie Fiction popped into my head. I'm like, but I don't even know where that book's going. And I said, well, I've got this idea and I don't even know what it is. And he's like, well, tell me the idea. And I said, okay, so guy's sitting on his couch and there's a knock at the door and he gets up and he goes and he opens the door and there's the woman that he and his best friend killed 19 years ago. I'm like, and that's all I got. And he's like, I got chills. He's like, that's the one. He's like, write that one. He's like, I want to hear that book. I want to read that book. Yeah. And so I was so inspired from that conversation. I went straight up to my my hotel room and I just got lost writing a chapter for like half an hour. And I got done and I had come up with this notion for time travel, like this notion that I hadn't seen before. And it just kind of popped out of my head. Like if I was going to time travel, I was going to imagine time travel, how do I think it would work? And I mean, there's so many different versions of time travel. And I've since realized that there was one TV series that came very close to what it was that I was thinking of. But at the time, I was like, I've never seen this. And so I immediately called my friend, Chris Mandeville, who I mentioned before. And she was at the conference also. And I picked up the phone and I said, Chris. She's like, yeah, what? She could sense the urgency in my voice. She's like, what? What is it? And I'm like, I think I just wrote something brilliant. And she's like, really? I'm like, yes. She's like, where are you? I'm like, I'm in my hotel room. She's like, okay, I'll be right there. So she came up and I read it to her and I got to the end and she's like, I think that's brilliant. And so that was the beginning of where the writing muse just grabbed me, by the throat and dragged me through 17 days of writing where my family didn't even barely see me. I mean, I came down for dinner, grabbed my plate, and went back up to my room like some hermit. And for 17, over the course of 17 days, I wrote 60,000 words on this novel, the whole first rough draft, boom. And I would, as I got done with each chapter, I would call Chris up. I would say, I have another chapter. She's like, great, let me put down my coffee and read it to me. And so I read it. And so we almost had this sort of in tandem journey where I was writing and she was listening. And we moved through the story of Charlie Fiction. And it was an odyssey unlike any other book I've ever written, where it just consumed me. Mm-hmm. And then I spent about 3 months after that just going through it, because it was all written in that same kind of slapdash, you know, this is what I'm passionately thinking right now, this is what I'm feeling, and this, and as things started to fit in, I would start to put it together more and more and more. And then as I got to those 3 months, I mean, it took me 17 days to write the thing and 3 months to try and put it together correctly. As I did that, it really started to come together, and I'm just so excited about putting it out into the world and seeing what the readers think of it.
Yeah, looking forward to reading it. It sounds like in our own literary world, like making sausage.
Right, right.
And how it started, and the notion, again, you just wanted to, you know, write that first paragraph. What's that like? You know, and so it became a writing exercise. And then how it incubated there for, I guess, a couple of years. And then that synchronistic flow of events. You go to the conference, and who was the author? You said, write this?
It was an agent, actually. Agent. Donald Moss, yep.
Okay. And, you know, so you get inspired. Okay, I'm going to get into this. And then you make this, you know, connection with Chris, you already had.
Yes.
Who's now reinforcing you and bouncing ideas. And this is the way great literature comes about so often, and you go into another world, and it's hard to explain, but I think you just explained it. When we try to tell people, I don't sit down, it's not like putting an article together for a paper, an essay for a scientific journal or something like that. This thing just explodes in you, and to get it down and get it right,
it's almost like you're surfing a wave, and you know if you even hesitate, if you hesitate just even a second, the wave's going to pass you by, and maybe you'll catch another wave, but this is the wave you want to ride. So I'm very thankful that I have such an understanding family, especially my wife, Laura. She is just so supportive, and when I disappear like that, she's tolerant of it for about probably 5 to 10 days, at which point she's like, okay, how long is this going to go on?
But she won't forget the time when you put the kids to sleep and everything.
Right,
like that.
Yes.
So that's a long, lifelong gap.
I gained points that night. Totally gained points that night.
Yeah, Laura's going, okay, I need to jump in this conversation here. That's fabulous stuff here. Now, I'm just so excited, anticipating reading. I'm champing at the bit here, licking my chops. But you have a character. His name is Vincent.
Vincent, yes.
Okay, that's the main character.
That's actually the villain.
The villain?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
All right. What's the main character's name, then?
The main character's name is Daniel.
Oh, well, that's kind of sneaky for me, because my main character's next book is Daniel also.
Oh, excellent.
We'll need to talk about Daniel.
Let's
Daniel,
do it.
Because there may be some correlation. Something in the name, because you become very careful on how you pick a name for a character, right? I do, anyway. So talk about Daniel a bit. Well, you already have a bit, but then Vincent too. And why those names? And then a little bit more here about Vincent.
Sure. Yeah. So Vincent, I'm going to try not to put too many spoilers in what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But Vincent and Daniel are best friends from elementary school because of a shared experience. So they both live in Denver. The whole thing is set in Denver. Okay. And their fathers died when they were both in fourth grade. So they have this incredible bonding moment where they kind of connect to one another. And Daniel takes one lesson away from that moment, and Vincent takes another lesson away from that moment. And Vincent's take, the villain, Vincent, says love is what's wrong with humanity in general. Love is what enables us to or encourages us to be less spectacular than we can be. Love is what chains you to a workaday job and your desk for, you know, 40 years, using up all the best years of your life, and then you end up dying in a car crash on I-25, which is what happened to Vincent's father. And so he says that love is the carrot that is dangled in front of the sheep, and the sheep go after this carrot, which puts them into this well-worn groove that they will never get out of for the rest of their lives. Yeah. So he is very opposed to this whole hormonal aberration that is love and sex, and the pursuing of such a thing is just ridiculously a waste of time. Daniel, our hero, on the other hand, and you'll probably be able to tell that I'm a diehard romantic by the time you get done reading Charlie Fiction. It's pretty edgy and kind of hard-boiled in some places, but I tend to write fast-paced fantasy novels that have a strong romantic element to them. So Daniel opposes that viewpoint vehemently. He thinks love is the coolest thing ever, and he likes the fact that his mother loves him and that he's attracted to these girls in middle school. There's a couple of scenes in the story where we catch up with Daniel and Vincent when they're young, when they're pre-adolescents, when they're adolescents, and then later on when they're adults. And Daniel makes the case for love, and Vincent makes the case against love. And giving all kinds of examples of, you know, wasting your time chasing girls is like the most, what's the word I want to say? The most tired, old, replayed story that we've ever seen. You know, the people who are great move past that and do something different than that. And so, anyways, the interesting point, and in my opinion, the best villains are always like this, where you can kind of see where Vincent's coming from in certain cases. He makes a very good argument in certain elements, but to me, when you step back and look at it from the 10,000 foot view, like if there isn't love, then what really is the purpose of life? To just keep racking up accomplishments over and over and over again? You know, I mean, one of those things that I've seen online a few times where they talk about people on their deathbed. What do they wish they'd done more? And not a single one of them said, "I wish I'd put in a little more time at the office." You know, what you hear is, "I wish I'd connected with my daughter who I was estranged from. I wish I'd spent more time with my kids when they were young. I wish I'd, you know, kissed that girl in high school that I had the crush on and I never had the courage to go up and talk to." You know, I mean, these things that don't have anything to do with money or accomplishment are the things that people talk about when they're closing out their time, right? So it's the theme of the book is power versus love, because Vincent is all about power and Daniel is all about love. Rather than the power of love, right? The love of power versus the power of love. Yes. Yes, exactly. Daniel, what makes him unusual, he's not just a starry-eyed romantic. He's also utterly brilliant. And he is kind of behind the reason that Vincent has been so successful as a businessman. Daniel comes up with the inventions, and Vincent is the charismatic face behind the business that makes him a world power. Anyways, I think I've said too much at that point. I don't want to spoil anything. It's fast paced.
Yeah.
It's gritty, and there is an ending you will not see coming.
I don't think you, from my point of view, of course, you're the writer, that you have said too much.
Okay, good.
That you, because I'm so hooked into, of course, my mind travels also because I'm thinking of Vincent. And these are not necessarily good correlations philosophers-wise. Albert Camus, Sartre, Nietzsche, and then a story of Faust himself.
Sure.
Okay. You know, so Goethe's Faustus, you know, who makes the deal with the devil. And all this, you know, one way to look at it is their sardonic, cynical view of life. But also, another way of looking at it is saying, well, what is the purpose of love? Well, if it is just attraction, so we create and, you know, move on to species, so there's a, you know, a next one in line. That's a very scientific and detached view of love rather than from the heart and energy to, and, you know, this is all fascinating stuff, I think, for anybody who truly thinks,
sure.
You know, to say, wow. And it's through characters like this, I think we can explore that, our own notions of it.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and I mean, it is something that occupies my mind a lot of the time, which is probably why I have a strong romantic element in just about all of the books that I do. Well, not in the middle school books that I do, but in the books that have the relationship content in them, I'm always asking the question, why would these characters get together and what is the benefit for them? Why, you know, how do they benefit from love in a relationship? It happens in Threadweavers also. I'm thinking of Threadweavers as well, which is the epic fantasy series that came out earlier this year.
Okay, and we'll talk back more about Threadweaver. I do want to remind our listening audience, so this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9, coming at you from the center of the universe, and that is Clear Creek County, Colorado. We're in the Goat Shack here. I'm visiting with my good friend and just absolutely hooked into what Todd Fonestock is saying here about his next work. Of course, I got a crazy mind that goes that way, and if you do too, I think you're going to love this work here. So I want to thank Todd for coming in. I am sponsoring this particular show, so if you want to learn more about my work, Sisyphus Wins, you can go to my website at jerryfabianic.com, and I'm excited. I'm moving my next, the sequel to it, and I mentioned Daniel, who is the kind of the star of the other one too. And I want to ask you a little bit more about Charlie Fiction. Back into Threadweavers, in terms of when is it going to be out for public and everything too. But I want to come back to this idea of character names. How much thought do you put into it? Do you, in the middle of a story or after a story is written, go through and say, no, this character is not Mary Beth, she is Elizabeth or something like that? How do you come up with that?
I feel like there's a spectrum, right? So on the one extreme, let's say the right-hand extreme of the spectrum, it comes to you instantly, in a flash. It's the name and that's the name and no other name could possibly be that name. Mm-hmm. And on the other end of the spectrum is, you're doing research, you're looking up what Russians name their babies, and you're looking up, baby books, and you're going through other old books that you've read, or perhaps, Greek names that are little known. Stay away from the mainstream Hercules and Apollo, but, look for more obscure names from mythologies long gone by. And I feel like when I'm creating a name, there's got to be ways to do it that are somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, but I have never visited them. I just don't. I feel like there's got to be a combination, but either it hits me like lightning or I can't ever seem to find the right freaking name. And I keep changing their name and changing their name until finally I'm like, I can't change it again because this is going to publication. So boom, there it is. Yeah. And I feel like Daniel, I think I thought a little bit about Daniel. I wanted it to be a name that was fairly likeable, you kind of feel relaxed around a Daniel. Like Daniel's not going to,
kind of like the Elton John song, Daniel My Brother.
Right, exactly. You can trust a Daniel, right? Yeah. Daniel's a good guy. He's not trying to stab you in the back. And usually I've noticed there are quite a few villain names that have the first letter of their name towards the end of the alphabet. Zakath is a good villain name. In Threadweavers, there's Zylock Morth is one of the villain's names. Jays are also pretty popular for villain names. Jafar, from Aladdin.
Jerry?
There you go. I didn't think about that. I threw you right in the line of fire, didn't I?
Oh, I love it.
I think Jerry's right over there with Daniel. So maybe, maybe that the first letter of the name isn't, you can't make a grand statement like that. But I always found V to be good for villainous names, not the least of which being that, villain starts with a V. So I think that's kind of how I came to the name for Vincent. And Charlie Fiction is one of the characters, and the book is obviously named after her. And that's a relatively unusual name in general, and probably a fairly unusual name for a woman. And although I have definitely seen a few movies and books that have a girl named Charlie. Mm-hmm. But I just loved the way it rolled off the tongue. And it was part of that first page that I wrote where she obviously gave a fake name. So in the first page of the book, you find that Daniel, Vincent are in Canyonlands, and out of the blue, they meet this goth-looking girl in a black leather jacket and ripped jeans who says her name is Charlie Fiction. And they immediately know she's lying to them, but what do they care? You know, she's wild and interesting, and they want to interact with this girl, right? And so I think that one was on the right-hand side of the spectrum where it just, boom, came out of the blue, and I named her Charlie Fiction, and then it just rolls off the tongue. I just love saying it over and over again. And I never looked back from that. Even when some people were like, what kind of name is that? I had, you know, some of my writer friends or whatever kind of question using the name Charlie Fiction. But I just, at this point, it seems like a name or the name of a book that has been there for 100 years that everybody already knows. That's the way it seems to me. Mm-hmm. So that's how Charlie came to be. And Daniel and Vincent, of course.
Yeah. And even her last name, Fiction, right away. This is not real.
Right.
You hit him right in the face with it too. So, all right. So we know this is not, she's not being upfront. She's here.
Right. It's not my real name. And she wants you to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's crazy. And good crazy.
Right.
But it reminds you.
Well, maybe.
We'll see. You know, right. How the sales go, right? You know, with 20 million people.
Oh, well, I thought you meant Charlie, herself. I'm like, is she crazy? Is she not? Well, you'll have to read and find out.
Oh, yourself. I see. Okay, yeah, no, it's good stuff. Yeah, because, you know, when I think of Daniel also, because, you know, Elton John is there. And you're right, Daniel, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, and the Irish. But also, Daniel, it was in the lion's den. Remember? In the biblical, in the Old Testament.
Oh, right.
And that's the allusion I draw on, because the title of my next work is called The Lion's Den.
So it's nice. Going in there.
But he's also heroic in that Old Testament story, mm-hmm. too. So it does have positive types of allusions there. But, you know, obviously there's a struggle that goes on there. He goes into a lion's den. Well, who wants to walk into a lion's den unless you've got a chair and a whip, and you better be damn good at it, too.
Right? Well, that sounds interesting. I look forward to seeing that one. When is that coming out?
Well, I'm moving it to my editor this week. Nice. And I would love, if I can, it's be aggressive is the word she used for it, is... see if I can get it done, printed, and out by mid to late October.
Sweet.
But a lot of it's going to be on the quality of my writing and how much he has to beat me up over it.
Of course. Too.
So, yeah. You know, I told her, I said, I put on my Hemingway hat, and I was imagining her, because she says, always resist the urge to explain, because I have a tendency to get mm-hmm. into and mm-hmm. explain every little detail. She quit doing it. So I just got Hemingway-ish, and I went and I just started chop, 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 whack, 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 and said, I don't need this here. Because really what they want to know is what the character is saying and feeling and everything, too. Yeah, background's nice, but once you get into the dialogue, you paint it, you're there, move on.
Event and reaction, yeah.
Yeah, so it's been, you know, an incredible learning experience for me, too, just like you pointed out in your journey here writing Charlie Fiction, you know, got you on a whole different wavelength here and how that's come about. It's fascinating.
It's great. Yeah, well, when I was on your show last, I talked about Dean Wesley Smith, and he has this writing into the dark mm-hmm. method that he uses. And Charlie Fiction was that and a bag of chips. It was like I started writing into the dark and I didn't know where it was going. And I feel mm-hmm. that because of that, it allowed a greater passion to come out than maybe ever before.
Yeah.
And the passion, I think the passion is the hardest thing to capture as writers. And you know this,
yeah.
Any writer I've ever known knows this, that the more you work on something, the more opportunity you have to beat the passion out of it. Because we, as writers, our minds are constantly going with all kinds of questions and a lot of doubt, right? Is this the right sentence? Is that the right sentence? Did I over-explain? You hear your editor in your ear. Did I over-explain here? Do I need to not explain that? Maybe I shouldn't explain at all. Maybe I should explain more. You know, I mean, there's so many choices to make in every single page that we kind of drive ourselves crazy. And if we start over-editing, if we spend too much time in our critical mind, that passion gets just stamped out.
Yeah.
And so giving yourself the opportunity to just live in that, to just, for as crazy and nonsensical and nonlinear as it is, to be tumble-dried in that passion creates something that you couldn't do if you were being sensible. Does that make sense?
Totally. Because that is rising, and I'll put it in a simplistic term, it, you know, in terms of that right brain, the energetic side of you, that's where the passion comes. And the, you know, where do you come up with these ideas? And they go, I have no idea. They just do. And you bring it to consciousness. But then there's that left brain side that says, well, like you say, do I over-explain? Do I don't hear, you know, and is this the right word? Should I use a more active word rather than a linking verb here or something like
maybe
that?
Maybe this whole chapter doesn't need to be here and I'm just wasting my time. And
And that's where I think a good editor really comes in, who knows you and the way you think. And Melly and I have really made a connection when she went through my first book. So we're on the same wavelength. So she gets what I'm trying to do.
That's the most important.
And then she can look at it all from that end, but also objectively and say, okay, you got too much here, not enough there. Here, let me rephrase this for you a little bit. And boom, I mean, we get it and you collaborate. That's where the editor really comes in.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I've seen good editors and I've seen not as talented editors. And the most talented editors that I've ever worked with and been around are the ones that their whole goal is to get behind your eyes. They want to see what you're trying to do. And once they get that vision, then essentially they're helping you achieve your vision. And the ones that I think don't do it as well are like, you know, here's the book of writing and here's what's good and here's what's bad. And you're not following this. Because I just feel like, or they see a vision that isn't yours and they're like, oh, this could be the next big Disney movie. And you're like, well, actually I was going for, you know, more of a, you know, indie, you know, off the beaten path kind of edgy movie. And I said, no, but it could be the best Disney movie. I mean, that's just, that never works out.
I want to go more to Sundance, you know, Utah with my stuff.
Right.
Or do like, what was it? I wrote The Martian, Weir. Andy. And, you know, because he just wrote it and there it is. And now it's an Academy Award winning movie.
Absolutely. You know, and a just absolutely fantastic novel. And I mean, and I read a little bit about how he came to write that. And he talked about how it was just, you know, this thing, this project that he was doing. He was in love with Mars and he was researching all this stuff on Mars and speculating about what would happen if this happened, what would happen if that happened, what would happen if somebody got stranded there, how long would they last? And what, you know, and that's what gave rise to the book. And I think you see that passion in the book. He was obviously passionate about Mars.
Oh, yeah. Fabulous story. Charlie Fiction, when was it going to be available?
Next week.
So cool. How good a timing is this, right?
It pubs on Tuesday, August 28th. Okay. And I'm going to be having a book signing at Tattered Cover on November 17th. So it's going to be a little down the road, but if you want to, if you want to meet me, if you want to get a book signed and get Charlie Fictions into your hand, I recommend November 17th, 2 o'clock at the Tattered Cover in Aspen Grove. So South Denver, Littleton really. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a time travel extravaganza. We're going to have a few authors there who write time travel novels. My friend that I mentioned, Chris Mandeville, has a YA time travel series out right now. It's called In Real Time, and it's fabulous. The first one, Quake, came out earlier this year. The second one, Shake, is going to come out on November 17th. So we'll be signing side by side, and we have two other time travel novel authors as yet to be disclosed. So if you're interested in time travel novels, you don't want to miss that event, November 17th.
The wheels are turning here in the brain. Who those might be there too. So this is now August something or other here. So we could time travel a couple months into, 3 months into the future.
Yep.
So we'll be there like instantaneously.
There we go.
Nick and I, Phoebe over there. Fun. this is great stuff there. So anyway, okay. So November 17th, Aspen Grove. Tattered Cover, not the downtowns ones. There are two downtowns there. So awesome there. And I'll need to look at my calendar because I think I am on the radio that day. We'll see. We'll see. We'll figure it out.
Well, give me a nod. I'll say hello to you from the Tattered Cover.
There we go. All right. But before we leave, I want to talk to you more about the Thread Weaver, not Thread Bear. The way I'm dressed is really Thread Weaver series. at any rate, I'm such a punny guy.
Today funny, I dressed for the radio.
Yeah, exactly. I got the face for radio. All right, I've heard that before there too. Let's go back to you touched on it earlier.
Sure.
And just kind of review for our audience here.
Yeah, so I mentioned before that epic fantasy was my wheelhouse, and then I moved into the middle grade portal fantasy of the Wishing World. So in 2015, I released Fairmist, which we talked a little bit about the last time. Mm-hmm. and then Wishing World came after that. Well, long before Wishing World and long before Fair Mist, there was a character named Wildmane. It's a little melodramatic sounding, and even the character Wildmane, whose real name is Metafay, dislikes the term Wildmane. It is the moniker that was pasted onto him by the poets and bards of the world that Threadweavers takes place in. But this character, this Metafay / Wildmane character, is a demigod. Okay, and he was created in a role-playing adventure that I had when I was in high school. I was with this friend of mine. So this is a very long time ago. I was with this friend of mine, Marvin, and we would do a lot of role-playing in his attic, right? Mm-hmm. And he created some characters, some wizard characters, and I created this fighter demigod character, right? And I wrote half a book that summer. It was the summer of my junior year of high school. I wrote half a book that summer with Wildmane as the main character. And Wildmane was everything that, as a 16-year-old, I wanted to be, right? He was tall, he was strong, he was good-looking, and he had this charisma that just oozed out of him everywhere he went, right? Not to mention the fact that he could explode into golden fire and destroy gods if need be.
Always a good so that's right. skill.
Why wouldn't that? You want to have that skill? Exactly. Like, that could come in real handy. So he... That story kind of died. I wrote for that summer, and then a lot of things happened in my life. My parents got divorced and moved away, and I ended up kind of fending for myself in certain ways here and there. Though Marvin's family, I lived with them for a little while, so they were quite a big part of me, of kind of catching my fall in those years. But long story short, the novel got put on hold. And then many years later, 3-4 years later, I went to college. I took about 3 years off after high school. And then I went to college when I was, what was I, 21 at that point? 21, 22? Yeah, 21. And I started writing on Wildmane again. I was like, I love this character. He just never went away. He was always in the back of my mind. And he seems like the type of character that you could write 20 novels about this guy, because he doesn't die. He's immortal, right? He lives forever. So I could just keep writing stories, you know, more and more and more adventures of Wildmane. And that's how the whole thing got started. And I wrote the very first draft of Wildmane, which is the first novel in the Threadweavers series. The very first novel, the very first draft of that novel happened when I was in college. And it became this kind of thing with my friends. I had this large group of friends when I was in college, and it kind of became part of our culture. Such that if we were leaving a restaurant or whatever, and there was some skeezy looking fellow standing on the corner, and he looked at us and came up and, you know, was, you know, maybe belligerent with us, and we kind of went away scared and like, oh my gosh, that guy could have pulled a knife on us or whatever, we would say something like, this story needs a Wildmane, because of course Wildmane can take care of any threat, like a skeezy stranger who might have a knife in his pocket. So it just kind of became part of the culture of my group of friends, and I would subject them to chapter after chapter after chapter of this story. Whenever I get a new chapter done, I would make them sit down and read it to them. And so that's how the first draft. Anyway, so wrote that first draft in college. A few years later, I was living in New York City, and I wrote the second and third books in the series, which at the time were named The Human Lands and Threads of Emerion. And then finished that in 2003 and put it to bed. Moved on to other projects. Moved on and actually got published by our first big publishing house, HarperCollins. Me and Giles wrote a trilogy, the Hearthstone trilogy, and that kind of came right around that time, actually. I think I finished that in 2003, and we started getting attention for Heir of Autumn, which is the first novel in the Hearthstone trilogy, in 2004. So it was actually the project that we started right after, which kind of leads all the way to today, right? That began the publishing journey for me, becoming, instead of a writer, an author who had actually been published. Anyways, so I put it to bed. But as with before, Wildmane kept creeping into my head, and I had friends from New York and friends from college that, as I published more books, they're like, whatever happened to Wildmane? I thought that was going to be like the big book for you. Why did that not ever get out there? And so finally, in this day and age of indie publishing and small press publishing and that sort of thing, I'm like, there is no reason that this story can't be out in the world. So why don't I take a look at it and see if it's something that I actually want to bring out of the trunk. Now, by and large, I am not a big fan of writers going back and working the same manuscript over and over. I am a big proponent, and I will tell you and tell anybody who asks me writing advice, it's like, get done with your first book and throw that thing, you know, to the side and work on the second book. Your skills are going to improve. Like, you will unconsciously become a better writer the more you write. Yeah. So get it done and move on, right? Which is why I put that aside and I didn't go back to it. But so many people that were in those groups in college and in those late nights in New York that said, I loved that story. Why didn't you bring that story out? And I'm like, oh, I wasn't as good a writer back then, and I just didn't know what I was doing craft-wise, and I just don't want to. Well, so I dug it out of the trunk, and I went through it and updated everything to my current level of writing ability, my craft ability. Now I put into the story from then, but I tried not to change the story. I didn't want to. Because actually, I actually tried to rewrite the story at one point and send it around to the previous fans of the original, and they all hated it. They're like, I hate this. This is not at all what the original story was. Yeah, so I wanted to preserve the original story and release it, finally release it. I almost said re-release it, but it's never been released before. And the response has just been so fantastic. I told you about the girl that sent me a message, and I've had other people that are just like, oh my gosh, you can so totally tell that you've spent 20 years thinking about this, because the world is just deep, and the world building is so complex, and the gods of the world, the pantheon of the world, there's so many different things that they have done. And in fact, if people sign up for my readers group, they get the free timeline of Amerion that shows from the beginning of the world, when the gods created the world, all the way to where Wildmane, the book that was just released, starts. And it just kind of shows you all the wars between the gods, and you know how the gods created the five different sentient races and all the different things all the way down the pike. These are things that I've been adding to just a little bit here and there for years now. And I never even thought about it until this other friend of mine who just finished it. He's like, oh my gosh, I love how you can tell that there's so many layers of this because you've been thinking about it for 20 years. So it's an epic fantasy story that has very deep world building. And another comment that I had received is also very strong female characters. I don't see why all books don't have strong female characters. It just doesn't make any sense to me that they don't. One of my favorite quotes ever is Joss Whedon, who is one of my creative heroes. I love Joss Whedon. He directed the first two Avengers movies. He did Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He did Firefly, which is just a magnificent piece of art, no matter how you look at it. Somebody once asked him in an interview, he's like, so why do you write such strong female characters? And his answer was, because of the fact that people like you are still asking me that question. It's like, that is a no-brainer, is essentially what he said. And so anyways, so if you like strong female characters, it's a good story as well. It centers around Mirala in the end, which is kind of ironic that the book is called Wildmane, and originally when I first started writing it, as I mentioned, it was all about Wildmane, this character Wildmane. But Mirala was supposed to be a side character, and she ended up taking over the story. She ended up being the one that had the character arc, and so she goes from, she has the fantasy trope character arc, where she starts scared, alone, and with this flicker of power, and she goes from that through all of these journeys to the end of the book. And I won't spoil anything for you, but hers is the character arc to watch.
All right. And, you know, and on a series like that, well, one comment again, you know, about Charlie Fiction and how it incubated.
Yes.
And this one incubated in a way, different way, but
nonetheless. Different way, but definitely, yeah.
It comes back to you and to say, okay, it's back here for some reason, and I'm going to go with that, and here you are, you know, finding success with that. And we're just about out of time here, but I wanted to ask, because you've got your event at the Aspen Grove Tattered Cover. That's in November. But you're going to be at the Georgetown Book Nook in December. So listening audience here, you got to come up. Todd, you're going to be there?
Absolutely. And I was there last year. It was my first year going to the Book Nook for the, it's the Georgetown Christmas, what was it?
Christmas Market. Christmas Market. We're in the Heritage Center.
Yeah. And it was such a hoot. I didn't know what to expect. there are so many people that are, you know, kind of looking around, and there are so many great authors there, all Colorado local authors with every kind of book that you can imagine, every kind of different genre that you can imagine, from, you know, kind of self-help yoga to like very, very young middle grade Arthurian tales to adult sci-fi fantasy to self-help to historical military fiction. I mean, it ran the gamut. I was just so pleased to be among that group and to talk to people. That was the funnest part. People come in and they love stories, and you just get to talk to them about stories and tell them stories. So yeah, no, it's a great time. And if you haven't gone, you should go.
Well, and we're doubling it for next year. We have one room. Yeah. And of course, we're going to use two rooms now. So I'm already getting booked in.
You're going to have to start, like, you know, doing a room for every genre or something.
We'll have to put an addition on that 1874 building. I don't know if the town will approve that, but you never know. That's great stuff. And yeah, loving it there. But in the meantime, you mentioned, like, your writer's group sign up, your website. People want to hear more about you, learn more.
Yeah, toddfonestock.com. So that's,
spell that.
Yeah, T-O-D-D, F as in Frank, A-H, N as in Nancy, E-S as in Sam, T-O-C as in cat, K.com. And right at the top there, if you do that on a phone, it'll be right at the top of your phone. If you do it on a computer, it'll be in the upper left-hand corner, is my readers group. You can get the free timeline for Threadweavers for the Land of Amarion. And if you sign up for my readers group, you get the opportunity for contests, free stuff. I have advanced readers. In fact, there are advanced readers working on Charlie Fiction right now. They got to read it before anybody else gets to read it. So if you sign up for my newsletter, you get notified about those opportunities, as well as I put in funky stories about my kids. They are a hoot. And if you like hearing stories about people, you know, random strange things that people's kids do, that's also fun. And then I also talk about the places that I'm going to be, appearances that I'm making, things like that.
Yeah, and I just got to tell you and tell everybody that's listening here, you've been with me a couple of times here, and I've obviously worked with you on the outside as well. And I got to say, no one does it better. You're such a fantastic, delightful storyteller. You just did it again. And I watched you last year at the Book Nook, and I tell you, you always had a crowd around you there and a great display. And the next thing you know, and people are like, and you sold a ton of books. And that's all the better, you know. So, and we got to get it back into people's heads here. You know, you're looking for stocking stuffers like at Christmas. Nothing better than a book.
Absolutely.
Right on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So looking forward to that, of course, you know.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Exactly. All right. Okay, everyone. This is Jerry Fabian, KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And I've been visiting here on Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole with Todd Fonestock. And I have this recorded. I'll have it up on the website at the Big Horn Book Club. And we'll get it up there the next day or two. So if you missed any of it, want to hear it again, of course, you know. And, you know, so you can go to it there. And Todd will have it, you know, linked to his website.
Absolutely.
As well.
So, I have the last one still on my website.
Exactly. You know, this is great stuff here. So, all right. We'll be back in a few minutes and, in about 30. And I'm talking with my next author. In the meantime, let's enjoy some music and let's move.